Committee on Public Employee Retirement System to order. We have most of the committee members present. Thank you for coming. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2003 and let you know that the amendments are not quite ready for prime time, but getting closer. And the fiscal is not quite there yet either, so Thursday is likely the day, but this was the only day that Greg Hartman could come and talk about them. And I think generally the aspects haven't changed significantly. Still talking about the 6% employee contribution and moving that into a transitional contribution account.
Yeah.
Transitional account. And then the 8% guarantee issue, modification thereof, and then the 2% COLA issue, and probably elimination of the call and also independent counsel. I think those are the key elements. So for those of you who are wishing to testify today, so Greg, why don't you come on up and take a stab at it, even though you don't have amendments in front of you.
So how do you like them?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Greg Hartman. I'm here representing the Purse Coalition. I had delivered or emailed down this morning a letter, and I understand each of you have a copy. And first of all, I want to apologize because the letter got a little longer than I intended. I intended a short letter, but you know how attorneys are. Once we start talking, sometimes we can't slow down. Greg Chamoff expressed in his opinion a couple of months ago that aspects of the then-existing House Bill 2003 were going to have constitutional difficulties if the legislature decided to pass them. And then I know Mr. Gary responded by not only testifying but also providing his letter in which he criticized, was very critical of Mr. Chamoff's analysis or lack of analysis. And while Mr. Chamoff needs no defense from me, since he's more than able to defend himself in his opinion, but I did really set out to write what started as a relatively brief letter, because what I really wanted to point out to the committee was that though Mr. Chamoff's analysis was pretty brief, it was right on the money. And if I can just take a moment, and I'll explain why this letter got a little longer. Everybody is in agreement that there is a purse contract. I mean, no one, I think, even my colleague, Mr. Gary, has disputed that basic proposition. So the question you have to ask yourself is, what does that mean? I mean, what do those words mean? And so I went back to the cases to try to see if I couldn't find some language which would help us understand what that means. And I was pleasantly surprised, if you will, when I went back to the Oregon State Police case, which is the Measure 8 case, to find, and frankly I'd forgotten this, that the court had gone through quite an extensive review of the cases going all the way back to 1940 in a case called Crawford against Teachers Retirement Fund, and had quoted from each of those cases. There were probably about 15 quotes in the case, and I put about 10 of the 15, it seems like, in this letter. And what the cases have said over and over and over is that what has been promised to members in the pension contract is benefits. In other words, it is a benefits analysis. If members have been promised a certain level of benefits, what the cases have consistently said since 1940, in one way or another, is that the employer is bound to honor that commitment and to pay the promised benefits. Now, the cases have developed over the years. I'm not saying the law in 1940 is identical to what it is today, because obviously we're talking about many cases that have addressed various aspects of this. But consistently, over and over, the court has said the benefits are the level of protection that the court is going to look at when they do their analysis. I even handed up just before the hearing 2 pages from the Oregon State Police case, and it looks like this for those of you who have it in front of you. And what I've given you is the court's entire specific discussion on the issue of whether the 8% guarantee, or as the court called it here, the guaranteed rate of return, whether that's contractual and whether it's going to be protected. So, despite the fact that Mr. Chamoff was criticized for being brief, as you can see, it doesn't take the court a whole lot of ink to go through their analysis. And I've underlined what I think is the key sentence in what amounts to one page of analysis. And as you can see, that key sentence, what I've underlined, indicates, again, the focus of the court is on the protection of the benefits. And the court finds that the guaranteed rate of return was, in fact, one of the promised benefits which the court is, or at least in that case, decided was going to be protected. So I'm not going to go back through the letter and read through the many, many quotes, but I simply bring them to your attention. And I did not go back to the cases themselves. What I did was simply take the quotes that the Oregon State Police case felt was most appropriate and included him in this letter. So about 90% of the letter, up until you get to the discussion of the governor's proposal or the governor's plan, are not my words. They're the words of the Oregon Supreme Court, or in some cases the Oregon Court of Appeals, over a period in excess of 60 years. I know there has been the suggestion that we have some judges who are different on the court today than the judges who were there when the Measure 8 case was decided. But again, as I've said before, while that makes a difference, and I agree that that does make a difference, the law as we know it on this was not invented in 1995 in the Measure 8 case. In fact, it has been developed, as I say, in the state of Oregon beginning in approximately 1940. And through many, many justices and many other judges on the Court of Appeals, there has been a consistent thread through those cases. So I would submit to you that though Mr. Chamoff was pretty brief, and he gave you only conclusions, which I think are appropriate in a really a memo, this was not a full-fledged opinion, I think his analysis was right on the money. And I think that you will find, as we eventually go to court and ask the judges what the proper rules are to apply, that the focus of the judges will be on the question of whether there's been a substantial change in benefits. And if the judges find that there is, the cases would suggest, and again, this is consistently for many, many years in many, many cases, that they will find that to be either a breach or an impairment of contract, depending on exactly, I don't want to get into the difficulties of that analysis, but one way or the other, they will find that the legislature has taken an action which constitutes a breach or impairment of contract. I'd like to talk a little bit about the governor's proposal, but I did want to mention one other thing. And I don't know how much it's motivating this committee in terms of time, but I have seen editorials, I have seen comments that there's somehow a 30-day window in order to make whatever changes the legislature cares to make. And I do want to point out to you that's a totally artificial window. It is true that the first actuary has said that he cannot, in other words, he can't change the numbers overnight. He needs to know what it is the legislature wants to do. But there's nothing that would prevent the PERS board from delaying any increases for a month or two. Frankly, that would not have a terrible adverse impact on the system, and there's plenty of precedent for that. So I say that only to suggest to you, I know you're anxious to move forward, and you're probably anxious not to have me come down and testify, and I don't blame you. But on the other hand, I think that's an artificial deadline, and I think these issues are far too important to feel that you have to be motivated by that timeline. So if for any reason the legislature feels that's moving too quick, I think it would be very easy to extend that timeline. And I can't speak for Mr. Johnson and I can't speak for the PERS board, but there's plenty of precedent of the board setting those increases or staggering increases or doing something which would permit the legislature to act, and nonetheless, assuming that you do pass something, have some significant relief to employers. So let's turn to the governor's proposal as I understand it. And as Representative Cano pointed out, we don't have language yet, so I'll simply respond to the concepts as I understand them. The 6%, as it has changed, and I'm sure someone will correct me if I'm not understanding it correctly, but the prior version of 2003 simply allowed for, I guess, what I would call a collective bargaining approach to what to do with the 6%. My understanding of the governor's proposal is that the 6%, which is currently contributed by employees, will be put into a separate account, which I assume will essentially be the equivalent of a defined contribution account, and that it would accumulate whatever it accumulates and be available to be paid out of retirement, something of that nature. When you think about it, what that really means is the only change which is being made in current PERS is, in effect, a ratcheting down in the eventual elimination of the money match. Because the 6% is still going into the system, but rather going into employee accounts as we currently understand them, it's going to go into a new account, as I said, presumably to earn interest over time and be available for a payout. Now, I don't think there can be any question that this constitutes an adverse impact on benefits, because to the extent the legislature is trying to achieve a savings, every dollar of savings is, in fact, an adverse dollar impact on benefits. So I don't think there's any argument to be made on that issue. So the question then becomes, is there something in the statute which would suggest that when the legislature passed the money match way back when, that they somehow left the door open for the legislature to make some change? And so I went back and actually looked at the language, and I quote this in the letter that I handed up to you, the money match language, and it's part of 238.300. And just to remind you how the money match came about, it was, in fact, the original pension benefit for the system back in 1945 when the system was created, and continued to be the sole source of benefit until 1967 when the legislature passed the pension plus annuity option. The legislature eliminated money match in 1967, but when they discovered that that was going to have an adverse impact on some participants, they reinstated it in 1969. And the way they did that was they simply inserted a provision which said that a minimum benefit would be the amount of the employee's account plus, and here's the language of the statute taken from, as I said, and I've got the citation in the letter, the actuarial equivalent of the annuity, a pension under this subsection shall be at least the actuarial equivalent of the annuity provided by the accumulated contributions of the member, hence the money match. There's a match of the employer. Employer matches what's in the employer account. Now, I would suggest to you that that language is specifically promissory. It says the pension shall be at least, and then it goes on to explain how the money match is going to be calculated. So there's nothing in the language of the statute which suggests that the legislature, when they passed this back in 1969, was leaving the door open for some amendment down the road. The language is very, very specifically promissory. We all know that money match is one of the significant benefits, today perhaps the most significant benefit of the plan. So if we apply the, frankly, pretty straightforward analysis that the courts have applied, again, since 1940, and I would call your attention to the numerous quotes in my letter, which, again, are quotes not selected by me, but selected by the judges in the Oregon State Police case, I would suggest to you that this proposal is going to have a great deal of difficulty in getting by the Supreme Court, since it seems to fly directly into the face of the consistent analysis the court has used for many years. The second part of the governor's proposal, as I understand it, goes to the what we've always called the 8% guarantee. Essentially, as I understand the material I've seen, and I did not have the opportunity to hear Margaret Halleck testify, nor have I had the opportunity to listen to it on my computer, but what I've understood the governor's position to be is that they feel that they have reanalyzed ORS 238.255 and have now come to the conclusion that it was the intention of the legislature back in the early 70s when this statute was passed to guarantee that each employee would receive over the course of their career 8% or whatever the guaranteed rate is and not receive that on a yearly basis. That's my understanding of what I understand the governor's understanding to be of this language. The problem is, and here again, I've quoted the language for you, and it's on page 6 of the letter, and I've just taken it right out of the statute. And, I won't read through the language, but as you see, and I have underlined the phrase each year, it's hard for me to understand how anyone can read this language and suggest that what the legislature had in mind back in the early 70s was not each year, since the language very, very specifically says that. And also, if you look at the language, again, the language is very promissory in nature. Promissory in the sense that it's saying to PERS participants, this is what we are going to do each year on a yearly basis. So I really have to take exception with the governor's analysis of ORS 238-255. I think it is simply not susceptible to the analysis of saying that this is a promise to be made over a career rather than year by year, because I think the statutory language is simply inconsistent with that basic reading. And also, of course, we have 25, 6, 7, 8 years of practice behind us when everybody has construed this to be a yearly commitment. Again, if we set aside this interpretation for a moment, then we are right back, it seems to me, with where we were in the Measure 8 case, because all that is happening by passage of this particular provision is doing away with the guarantee. Because though I've not done any independent analysis, and I'm not Mark Johnson, so I can't crunch the numbers like Mark can, my assumption is that if this passes, that there will not be a required payment for most, if not all, of Tier 1 participants throughout the remainder of their career. In other words, if we go back and see how much they have been credited, let's say somebody who started 20 years ago, just arbitrarily, they have been credited a sufficient amount in the first 20 years of their career so that if the guarantee becomes one over a career, over a lifetime, that there will be no additional crediting, or at least none required, as I understand it, the way this would work, throughout the remainder of their career. Now, to me, that's simply the equivalent of eliminating the guarantee. And, of course, that's precisely what Measure 8 attempted to do and precisely what a unanimous court said you cannot do. So I don't feel there's any, as far as I understand the proposal, there's no functional difference between this proposal and Measure 8 unless, and I have to say unless you can support the governor's reading of the statute that this is not meant to be yearly. But again, I placed the language of the statute in front of you, and I won't make a lot of argument. It says quite clearly that this is something that's going to happen each year. So I think it's just impossible to get to where the governor wants to go in light of the precise statutory language. And finally, the only other thing specific on the governor's proposal, again, as I understand it, COLA increases for a targeted group of retirees, and I think it's those who retired after 1999 and before 2004, somewhere in that basic range, are not going to receive COLA payments until there's been some, and I don't understand the precise mechanics of this, but it's not important, until there's been some payback, if you will, of the amount which, at this point, the governor apparently has bought into Judge Lipscomb's analysis that in 1999 there was too much distributed to employee accounts. So as I understand it, people who are retired will lose some COLA until some adjustment, and I'm not quite sure how the adjustment's going to work, but again, that's a detail that probably isn't all that important. Of course, I have to point out to you that this proposal is no better than Judge Lipscomb's opinion, and with all respect to Judge Lipscomb, we will not know the answer to how good his opinion is until it is reviewed in the higher courts. Also, I want to point out to you again that Judge Lipscomb made this decision on behalf of 8 employers, and the legislature, if they move forward on this proposal, are really treating it as if Judge Lipscomb made this decision for all employers, and there are some significant legal issues which stand in the way of simply jumping from point A to point B. It would take me far too long to go through those, but I'm happy to do that if that is of interest to any member of the committee, but I won't do that today unless you specifically ask me to. But again, going back to the language of the COLA, because I think that's what you have to look at, is the language of the COLA. And I have, again, quoted it in this letter. It's from 238-360. And again, you see the language is specifically promissory. It specifically says that there is a certain benefit which is going to be paid to retirees. So, again, you are founding this particular provision, this particular proposal, number one, on Judge Lipscomb, and again, flying in the face of some very, very specific promissory language. Just a couple of final thoughts that I'd like to leave you with, and of course I'm very happy to answer any questions if I've raised any questions at this point that I've not answered. What happens, I heard Mr. Gary say on more than one occasion, look, if you go ahead and do this, and it turns out the courts say you went too far, or you can't do it, or whatever, what's the harm? Because after all, we simply go back to the old system, and so what is the real harm? I think that's far too simplistic an approach, and let me suggest why. If you do go too far, the courts decide you've gone too far, they may well say that what you've done is impair a contract. Now, if it's an impairment, that makes the provision goes away as if it never existed. But what is much, much more likely to happen in this case, and I think it's something we mentioned before in testimony, and I know, frankly, even Mr. Gary agrees with me on this, that if the court rules in our favor, it is much more likely to be a breach of contract rather than impairment of contract. Now, to non-lawyers, we're probably saying, who cares? You know, that's one of those things that doesn't sound like it makes a lot of difference, but it makes an enormous amount of difference because the court will say, you're permitted to breach contract. The state, like any other entity, can breach their contracts. That's what happened in the Hughes case, which had to do with taxation. But then what the court said is, having breached the contract, it's now up to the legislature to figure out a way to fix it, to pay damages. You could well end up in the circumstance where if there is a decision that the legislative enactment has breached the contract, that it will not be very easy to unwind. There will have to be payment of damages. There could well be damages outside the PERS system itself, because individual employers will be liable for those damages. All 800 individual employers plus the state will be liable for those damages. So I just leave you with the thought that this is not a circumstance where the legislature has a free pass, if you will, to take a crack at something and see how it works out and say if it doesn't work out, no great harm will be caused, because it will simply fall back into place and it will be no worse or no better than it was before. I don't believe that's necessarily the case. And let me now flip-flop, if I may, and say, what happens if the court says you can do this? It's okay. And for whatever reason, the court, despite our excellent argument to the contrary, says, no, we think this is okay. You know, legislature can do this. What's to prevent, and let me back up and say, when I look at the governor's proposals, I find no unifying concept among those proposals which redefines what pension contract rights are going to mean henceforth in the state of Oregon, assuming the Supreme Court said, yeah, this is fine, you can do this. And the reason I raise that is this: what value will the PERS promise have in the future if, in fact, this legislature can do what's in this proposal and the next legislature, if they so desire, can chip some more off of it, and so on down the road, legislature by legislature? You will have a system, if you can call it that, that I don't think will be one that is viewed favorably by employees, nor employers. Because we all know that pension is part of the important thing that brings people to work for state and local jurisdictions. And I think you've heard people testify to this effect, that it is important to have a good pension. We do want good people coming to work for state and local jurisdictions. But unless there's some unifying concept here that I'm missing, because the only concept I see is let's save money, unless there's some unifying concept here which redefines what a pension contract promise means in the state of Oregon, then it doesn't mean much of anything. And so it seems to me that as you go down this path and consider whether you do want to adopt the governor's proposal, there are tremendous risks if it turns out okay according to the court, and there are tremendous risks if the court says it's not okay. And so I would ask you to consider both of those, because I think those are important issues. And again, I'm most troubled by the governor's proposal. Well, I don't like it for a lot of reasons, but I'm most troubled that I can find no unifying principles in it that tell me what a contract, what a pension contract promised in the state of Oregon is going to mean 2 or 3 or 4 years from now, assuming you pass this or something like it, and assuming the court says, yeah, that's okay, you can do that. And I simply can't find those principles. So with that thought, I will leave you unless there are questions. And again, I'd be happy to answer those. Or
I have a question, Greg, as it relates to the guaranteed rate of return. We all have dealt with this, and you know the assumed rate becomes the guaranteed rate. Now, the assumed rate is over a large period of time, and so I guess my question would be, if you have an assumed rate that's engaged over a 26-year period, but you have a guarantee that's being paid as you examined each year, as your language indicates, and it talks about the difference shall be credited to the regular account and charged to the reserve account in that fund established for that purpose. Well, as we all know, the reserve fund was insufficient or not built up. I mean, why wouldn't the court say, well, yes, there is an 8% guarantee, but it is, I mean, the contract is longer than just the each year language. It also assumes that there was an account there that was going to pay 8% in the years when there isn't 8% earning. So, I mean, why wouldn't the court say that it would be legitimate to modify that in that circumstance to pay it off over a longer period of time?
Yes. Let me respond this way, if I may. Keep in mind that back when the legislature passed this, and I believe it was a 73 session. I may be a session off one way or the other. I was in the early 70s. It was before I started practicing. I'm not responsible for it, and I never testified in favor of it, but nonetheless, it got itself passed. There was no reserve account, because my recollection is you had had 2 years of essentially zero earnings, which led up to the effort to pass this particular statute. And so what happened was the account which is referenced was a deficit account. And as a matter of fact, when the PERS system first operated to pay the guaranteed rate, which back then was, I think, 5.5% or some such number, they had to use a deficit account. So there was, in other words, there was no account available to use. And as you know, or as I'm sure you're aware, over the many years since then, with one other exception, until most recently, the reserve established by the PERS system has been sufficient to handle that. So when we come all the way back then to the question you asked me, why wouldn't the court simply say there's no reserve? The legislature didn't say back in 1973, we will give you a guaranteed rate if there's a reserve to pay it from. I guess they could have. I mean, they could have said it that way. But as you know, when we go back to PGE against Boley, which one of those cases that everybody cites in favor of their position, but the courts do start with simply reading the language of the statute and saying, if we find that the language of the statute is clear, then we really don't have to look at much of anything else. Now, I know the legislature passed a statute a couple years ago and said, well, you know, look a little bit at our legislative history, too. That doesn't hurt anything. But under PGE against Boley, they'll simply look at the statute. And I think the statute is very clear that what it contemplates is a yearly allocation of the guaranteed rate. Now, in hindsight, you know, as we sit here in 2003, was that a good policy decision for the legislature to make in 1973? You know, I'll leave that for someone else to answer. But the point is that what they did was they put it in the statute, and the statute has been held to be part of the pension contract. And coincidentally, it is, as you're well aware, a part of the contract which has already been challenged, already taken to the Supreme Court, and already held to be part of the contract. So that's the best answer I can give. I don't think you can get, I want to say to where you want to go, I don't think you can get to the position of having this sustained either by the governor finding meaning in here, which I don't think is here, and I don't think you can get there by saying, since we don't have the account, you know, we made the promise, but we don't have the account, and therefore we should not have to follow the promise. I think the courts can have great difficulty with that approach.
Well, I guess my point was is that
if you have an 8% guarantee and it's built on a, you know, a 26-year range, I think is what the assumed rate is based upon. If you credit more than 8% in any given year, you're never going to be able to fund the 8% guarantee unless you've started with a significant, unless you have earnings beyond that that you're putting into that account, and then you're getting great earnings returns on that, and over time you've built up a huge fund that just, you know, overwhelms the earnings in the future. So it just seems odd to me or illogical that the court would look at that and go, and this was sort of flawed from the outset in terms of the crediting policy, and therefore, you know, it needs to be fixed.
As you're probably as well aware as I am, and I'm trying to say this as politely as I can, but the courts have never been willing to say that simply because the legislature may have made an error in judgment that we will bail them out and save them. I know there have been arguments on many, I mean, this is not unique to PERS. As you know, over the last several years, we've had instances where the legislature has acted, and the courts really have said very specifically that, look, if the legislature does it, and it's clear that the legislature did it, and in hindsight, maybe it wasn't the best idea in the whole world, we won't bail them out. And I think this is very much what you have here. And I understand exactly the issue you're raising, the policy issue. There's great discussion of just that kind of thing in Judge Lipscomb's court, even though he didn't really specifically rule on it one way or the other, but we had extensive testimony and discussion of that issue. And it's an interesting philosophical debate about how this all works, and I grant you there's certainly an argument that as a policy matter, the legislature made the wrong choice back in 1973. But as you know, that's probably not enough to convince the court in and of itself. Now, there may be other reasons the court decides to do or not do something, but that all by itself is probably not going to get the court to do anything.
Well, regardless of whether we would agree with the 73 legislature and the 8% guarantee, the legislature didn't credit, you know, beyond 8%. Obviously, that was the PERS board that did that. And obviously, it's part of the case that Lipscomb ruled on in terms of excess, I think he called it excess crediting. Actually, probably a little more, it's probably a little different than that, but that's what I've called it, excess crediting. It seems illogical that would not be taken into account as it relates to the guarantee if they're going to uphold Lipscomb.
You know, I would hate to be caught saying the court would do something illogical, so I won't say that, but I think that the court operates, as you know, under a set of rules in terms of how they relate to legislative enactments, and they make it clear that they're not policymakers. Now, that's an interesting philosophical debate we could have about whether they are or not, but they recognize the legislature are the appropriate policymakers, and a mere argument that a policy is misguided or misjudged or misunderstood doesn't cut a lot of ice with them. That's just been my experience.
Representative Richardson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hartman, I'd like to talk with you for a moment, if I could, about three areas: the historical, the legal, and the social. You've mentioned the Hughes case, and in the Hughes case, one of the footnotes refers to a 1953 Attorney General letter on the issue of whether or not there's an opinion on whether or not there can be adjustments made in retirement plans. And in going back to that Attorney General opinion, one of the things that were stated is that the ruling permitting modification of pensions is a necessary one, since pension systems must be kept flexible to permit adjustments in accord with changing conditions and at the same time maintain the integrity of the system and carry out its beneficial policy. And that was, as we know, there was a change in the actual retirement plan back in the early 50s, and it was allowed to be changed. So historically, I don't think that your position is being necessarily fully sustained. From a legal standpoint, in your testimony, you've given a lot of weight to unilateral contracts and the fact that when a contract is made, one side just can't change it. But to me, it seems like the parameter of your argument is based on a situation where both sides enter into a contract, they both know what is to be expected from each other, and there's an expectation that both sides will be able to perform, and then just one side decides, we don't like the deal anymore, so we're going to back off. And I'm wondering whether or not another contractual legalism of mutual mistake may not apply here, since what is being proposed in House Bill 2003 is not a termination of the PERS contract, but a reinterpretation of the allocation of benefits from the way that the PERS board chose to allocate them in the late 90s, and in so doing it, not deprive members of benefits, but merely allocate those benefits not all at once and then take what you get in down markets, but allocate them with the understanding or the premise that the 8% accrued interest benefit was an average that was anticipated for 40 years and not a floor that the employee was going to get no matter what, and anything above it, good luck to them. And so as you testify to us and say, you know, watch out what you're doing, it seems to me that there are other ways that that could be looked at. The third is, and I think this may be the most important one, and that is the social aspect of what we're discussing, because a pension plan as it was originally decided or implemented and accepted by the employees was, as I look back over the history of it, an anticipation of a benefit that was somewhere in the range of 50 to 70%, and that neither side anticipated that from a strange lining up or alignment of events would result in pension benefits that are averaging over 100%, and by testimony that we've received within this decade, as things are currently compounding, will be averaging in the area of 125%, and that there will be some recipients who will be receiving 200% of their best year's wages. And if that was never anticipated, then that windfall has the unanticipated consequence of affecting all aspects of our society as we know it now. It expects how many teachers will be in the schools, how many children will be in classes, whether or not the textbooks are purchased, because even in my area, just the Medford School District, the anticipated increase in the PERS cost to deal with the unfunded actuarial liability, as far as what they're working with today, is going to be over $1 million more than what it was the last time. And $1 million in a school district, you know, has tremendous consequences. And so, while I am grateful personally for the legal approach and the quotes, I think that there's going to be more at stake than merely one legal approach to it as compared to another equally as valid legal approach, meaning that this has been a mutual mistake and there's been that what we have is a change in benefits, not a termination of benefits. And when you balance that with the social consequences of what's being advocated here, you're advocating in favor for your coalition, and very ably so, a windfall recovery of over 100% of retirement of earnings, where people can retire and make far more as a retiree than they ever made while they're working, which was not intended or negotiated by either party throughout the terms of the contract. And so, is it not possible that if you were to consider this aspect of history and this aspect of the law, contracts, and the social implications, that maybe your position may not be quite as strong as it seems to be coming across?
Representative Richardson, you've asked me a number of questions, not just one or two, and I'm not going to try to, and I appreciate your position, and I understand your position, and like any good attorney, you've used good words to advocate that position. You know, I'm not going to agree with words like windfall and mutual mistake and so forth and so on, but let me ask you a question by way of response, because let's assume for the moment that your approach, as you just articulated it, is an alternative approach. And so let me challenge you with this thought. Can you explain to me what protection, what pension protection individual members have assuming that the courts were to adopt your approach. In other words, what is the new, because it would be new, I think we both agree, it's not what the courts have said, it's going to be something new. Can you articulate for me what the new pension promise will be to members on a going forward basis? Because I have great difficulty with trying to understand, and I understand your suggestions. I suggest they're more of a political argument than a legal argument, but it's a good, I'm not saying it's a bad argument, it's a political argument. But what's the new bottom line? In other words, if you and I were sitting 3 or 4 years down the road, and let's say that based on your analysis, as you've just explained, that the court has in fact said, okay, we're going to do it this way, how would we explain to people who asked us, what's the new bottom line, what's the new protection for pension rights in the state of Oregon? I couldn't articulate it. I could not explain what that is. And that's what most troubles me, because I can't. And I think I said this to you before in prior testimony, there are other acknowledged basis for the protection of pension rights. For instance, the private sector has a different approach than the public sector, and the concept there is a protection of accrued rights, something I don't need to tell Representative McPherson. He's been a career working on that. But even though I may say that's not the correct analysis in the public sector, it's nonetheless a level of protection which is well understood. And from a policy perspective, again, assuming we had no Supreme Court cases to worry about and we were writing on a clean slate, we might say that's the best policy. But I can't find a policy, in your statement, I can't find a policy that I could articulate to say this is a new bottom line. Because what happens if 2 years from now or 4 years from now, the next legislature, when examining the social utility of the balance of these many factors, say, once again, it weighs against continuing to pay benefits at a certain level. Do the benefits then keep going down? Where's the bottom line? Where's the floor? Where's the articulated basis that says we can change it, but we can only change it this much? And I can't find it. And that troubles me greatly because, again, as I look at 2, 3, 4 years down the road, and while I'm confident of our legal position, I've been doing this far too long to say that anything is 100%. And so I'm not saying that. But what happens 2, 3, 4 years down the road if the court does buy that kind of analysis? Where's the bottom line? What do I tell my clients they have the right to expect at the end of their careers? And it's difficult for me to find that. I can't articulate it.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Harwin, of course, I know that you're advocating for your client and you're not asking my opinion since you know so much more about this than I do, but we all understand that the courts hear cases that can't easily be solved. In most instances, it's never going to go to a court, and in a case such as this, it has to go to the court because they're going to deal with the letter of the law versus substance over form, which is certainly one thing that courts use regularly to come up with a fair decision. And they also use the term fundamental fairness. And if it's a violation of fundamental fairness, then often they'll bend the law, as you well know, to come up with a reasonable result. And we also know that hard cases make bad law. And so I would assume that the Supreme Court is not going to be ultimately making a new law that will be applied broadly, but they will limit whatever their decision is to a very specific set of facts, as we have right here. And ultimately, they're going to have to make a decision, and I would suggest that people in the future will be looking at this case, whatever the decision is, as a unique fluke that the court had to deal with, and they had to make a decision as to whether it was fundamentally fair to punish society for an unforeseen consequence from a series of adjustments to a contract over a period of 45 years. And I think they'll probably be able to come up and do that, and certainly I hope so. And I want you to know I appreciate your position and all that you've advocated, and I just feel that it may not be cut quite as cut and dried as possibly you may have viewed it, and I certainly hope that that's the case.
You know, Representative Richardson, if there were any easy answers in this debate, we would have found them a long time ago. And we've acknowledged from the beginning that, you know, my clients are as concerned about these issues as everyone else, and there are no easy answers. I mean, we've said that from day one. So, I certainly appreciate your thoughts. And, you know, I've tried to articulate what I think is the current standard of the Supreme Court. Might they change their mind? Only time will tell.
Further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bill, did you want to We also, we have two other letters as well. And they are from E-Web and Peter. Oh, Kim Cotton. And we'll enter those into the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bill Gary with the law firm of Farang Long, Gary Rudnick. I intend to be even briefer this afternoon than I will be, but as you've probably noticed by now, Mr. Hartman tends to get my juices flowing a little bit, and I have a few comments in response. But I won't respond to everything he said. I'm happy to respond to any questions. One thing I want to start out with is the question of the timeline. What Mr. Hartman said, what's the big rush? And while I would agree that, you know, an arbitrary deadline such as you've got to have it done by May 1st or else we won't, the PERS board won't include it in the rates, that is something that can be worked around, but a deadline that is imposed upon every government employer, nearly every government employer participating in PERS, including the state, is the budget deadline. And what you do here will have a profound effect on what local governments and school districts and the state itself does with regard to its budget decisions. And so there isn't a lot of time to continue the interesting and important debate. I primarily wanted to comment today about the proposed amendments that you heard about last week to House Bill 2003, and then I'll have a couple of comments as we go along in response to some of the things that Mr. Hartman said. When the coalition of business interests and public employer groups that requested that House Bill 2003 be introduced, we did so with a couple of overarching goals in mind. Obviously, first and foremost, we sought to reduce the escalating cost of the public employees' retirement system and to try to begin to bring under control the burgeoning unfunded actuarial liability that you're all very familiar with. But also, we explicitly identified as a goal to address and to remedy, insofar as possible, the effects of past unlawful actions taken by the Public Employees Retirement Board, and to some extent identified in the City of Eugene decision by Judge Lipscomb. There is a confluence of circumstances that has led to the burgeoning cost of the system and, I believe, to benefits that are far beyond what this body ever intended would be produced under the system. The first is the existence of the money match benefit, and as I've testified before, that is something that was included in the statutes to cover a very limited number of people, but has grown to be the dominant method of calculating benefits. There is the 8% guarantee, or the assumed interest rate guarantee to be more precise, that has driven costs and benefits to ever increasing levels. But equally, if not more significant, is the practice, a number of practices of the PERS board that have the effect of increasing benefits, crediting member accounts with 8% interest every year, even in years when you don't earn 8% is one thing. Crediting them with 20% in a good year and 8% in a bad year is quite something different, as the chair's questions have suggested. And so we believe that it's important that House Bill 2003 accomplish both those goals and do so in a way calculated as best as human ability permits to pass muster in the courts. And we all recognize that that's both a difficult challenge and, to a large extent, one that cannot be completely 100% predicted. That is not, I believe, as Mr. Hartman would suggest, a reason to do nothing, because while it may be prudent to take no action if the risks associated with the action are great, and there are risks associated with taking action here, it is not prudent to do nothing if the risks of taking no action are demonstrably greater, and that is clearly the case here. The amendments that have been proposed conceptually, subject to a number of knotty details that I think need to be worked out, are, I believe, a constructive example of how the legislative process can improve a proposal that was brought to you in good faith and through the efforts of a great many people. I think we have are on the verge of producing a solution that is both more far-reaching and perhaps fairer than the initial proposal that you had before you. I think it's important that the bill recognize and address the three main areas that Judge Lipscomb identified as actions that the PERS board had taken that were inconsistent with statutes, and provide remedies for those actions. And I'll explain why I think it's important that you provide remedies for all three. They are different. There are two things that he identified that affect only people that have already retired: the calculation of the money match benefit for people participating in the variable account is one, and the other is the calculation of benefits using outdated mortality tables. People who are current members that have not retired are not affected by those unlawful actions because they're actions that take place at the point of retirement. The third problem identified, which is perhaps the most far-reaching, is the problem of overcrediting, the problem of crediting to member Tier 1 member accounts imprudent amounts in good years and leaving inadequate reserves to cover the down years. And I want to point out, and I think I've mentioned this before, but if I haven't, the record should be clear, that while Mr. Hartman is correct that the lawsuit was brought on behalf of eight employers, the eight employers challenged a decision in 2000 that allocated investment income to every single account in the PERS fund. And after a trial, Judge Lipscomb said, the employers are correct. You were incorrect in the way you allocated income. You are ordered to go back and do it again. So when Mr. Hartman tells you, well, this only affects the eight employers, he's simply wrong as a matter of fact and as a matter of law. As to the 1999 earnings, that is a decision by the circuit court that requires necessarily the PERS board to go back and reallocate those earnings as to every account. You can't reallocate it as to eight employers' accounts and not as to everybody else, because it's a zero-sum game. The proposed amendment deals with the problem of overcrediting in what I think is a creative and more fair way than the original bill did, because it will, number one, ensure that everyone who is a member of Tier 1 PERS, when they retire, will have an account balance that is at least the equal to the accumulated contributions plus interest credited on that account at the assumed rate. And in all likelihood, many members will still retire with far more than that. But the amount that has been credited in excess of the assumed rate in years, not only in 1999, but in other years, where the board, I think, pretty clearly with the benefit of hindsight, acted imprudently in crediting too much income, will be available, as it should have been, in a reserve account to even out the investment crediting in the down years. We're all hopeful that there aren't too many more down years ahead of us, but this bill provides a mechanism to recoup the excessive crediting in a way that does not require the board to go in and reach in and immediately alter the account balances of members and take money out of the accounts. Now, it's interesting to me when Mr. Hartman talks about the proposal with regard to the assumed rate guarantee, that he says, well, you have to look at the plain language of the statute, and the plain language says you should do it every year. And with all due respect to my colleague on the other side of this issue, I think that that is emblematic of the where we disagree about how you analyze contract rights. He says, well, there's a case called PGE versus the Bureau of Labor and Industries that says you look at the statute and you apply the words of the statute and you don't look beyond the statute. And he's right. That's the way the Supreme Court has told us to interpret statutes when you're trying to decide what they mean. But the question that you're wrestling with here is not what does the statute mean, but what is the content of the statutory contractual promise, if any, that was made. Now, we know that a contractual promise was made with regard to the assumed rate guarantee because the Supreme Court told us so in the OSPOA case. But what was it that was guaranteed? What was guaranteed was that they would be credited with no less than 8%. Not that they would get 8% in the down years and 20% in the good years. And it's interesting to me that the PERS coalition, I believe, if not being supportive, at least were not in open opposition to the bill that you previously passed that capped the crediting of the assumed rate at the assumed rate, so that on a going forward basis, Tier 1 member accounts will not receive more than the assumed rate, at least until certain conditions are met, that there's a sufficient amount of money in the fund to cover additional crediting. It's difficult for me to understand how you can say at the same time it would be a breach of contract to ensure only that a member's account is the cumulative 8% guarantee at the time of retirement, and yet acknowledge that there is no right to have more than 8% credited to one's account, because all we're really doing is adjusting the account balance by using that excess crediting as its own kind of individual gain loss reserve. Mr. Hartman also said that the reason that this is problematic, and I think the reason also that the 6% portion of the bill is problematic, is because of the money match language. And he used an interesting term. He said, when you read the money match language in ORS 238.300, that language is specifically promissory in nature. Now, I'm not sure what it means for language to be specifically promissory in nature, but I do know that the court has never said that the way you determine whether something is a contractual promise or not is by looking at whether the language is specifically promissory in nature. The court has said you look at what the legislature intended. And to do that, you look behind the language of the statute. You look at what was going on. And curiously, Mr. Hartman, in at least all the time that I have heard him testify, has never disputed the fact that when the money match language was included in the statute, it was included to protect a very limited number of existing members in 1969, and not to be, as he said, one of the most important benefits that is provided to PERS members. So we think that the committee with the amendments that you have before you is on the right track. There is a lot of hard work yet to be done to craft a bill that is as defensible as we can make it against inevitable challenges, and I think perhaps even more important, a bill that fairly deals with the problem that you're wrestling with as to how you allocate the burden of these costs. And so I look forward, Mr. Chair, to the amendments being printed and considered by the committee, and anticipate that we will offer our full support for them when they are.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gary, if you could refresh my memory a bit, when did your clients file the City of Eugene case?
Representative Nolan, Mr. Chair, I actually
I don't need an exact date.
I can't give you an exact answer to it, but there were several filings that were made, and I actually have 8 clients, and some of them filed in 1999, and some of them didn't file until 2000, I believe. There are 3 orders that are being challenged, the 99 earnings allocation, which happened in 2000, the 98 rate orders, and the 2000 rate orders, and not all of the petitioning employers challenged all of those orders. So,
follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. That is consistent with my recollection, and I wanted to make sure before I proceeded. But the area I really want to explore is that your challenge has been to principally 1999 is the discussion we've had most about, and you just now referenced a bit of 1998.
As to earnings?
Yes.
As to earnings, we only challenged the 1999 earnings allocation, which happened in March of 2000. There was no challenge filed to prior years' earnings allocations, 98, 97, 96, 95. With the benefit of hindsight, had we, based on the same principles, those years were subject to challenge, but there was no challenge filed.
May I continue, Mr. Chair? Thank you. And Mr. Gary, you're getting to my point. Because, as I recall, 1996, 97, 98, the crediting to regular accounts was also in excess of 8%. And as you yourself mentioned, the benefit of hindsight might have provoked you, had you had that wisdom when you filed, to challenge those. But you didn't, even though they exceeded 8%. So I guess my question is, what would give you to believe that anyone else knew this problem was going to be an issue? And if it was so evident that 1999 was a problem, why didn't you notice it the first time earnings were credited in excess of 8%?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I really want to break that down into 2 questions, because if you're asking me why I didn't notice it, it's because I wasn't retained until I was retained to look at the problem. If you're asking why the employers who retained me didn't notice it, I think that what happened is that in 1998 there was a dramatic increase in employer contribution rates for many participating employers. And that was a wake-up call in many respects for those employers because, like most of us, I think, they assumed that these robust earnings that the fund had enjoyed was just producing a wonderful situation for everyone. And it wasn't until they saw their rates increase in a year when the fund had had wonderful earnings that they began asking, why are we being asked to pay more to support this system at a time when investment income is so robust? And so that's the reason why the what triggered their inquiries when they did. And I don't want to suggest to anyone that it is obvious to a layperson or even a fairly sophisticated individual looking at the PERS system that there are problems, because it is, as we've discussed in the past, a very complex system that is almost designed with complexity to hide its underlying problems. And it took a significant amount of work and study and effort on the part of an awful lot of people to be able to identify the root causes of this problem. That as the investment incomes have plummeted, have become much more obvious and easier to see for everyone, but in the good times they were pretty well masked.
A little more, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And let me start by an acknowledgement that I think we do need to make sure that the PERS system is solvent for the benefit of everyone involved. But, for example, if you noticed this in 1998, I wasn't in the legislature in 1999. Did your clients bring a proposal to cap earnings credits to the 1999 legislature? I don't recall one in 2001.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, in every legislative session since at least the time that I became involved, employers in general, and specifically the eight employers that I represented the litigation, have been in the legislature asking for reforms that would curb the rising costs. And quite frankly, for quite a while, not from any present company and not even necessarily from legislators, but in general from the PERS coalition and to some extent from PERS board members, we were characterized, my clients were characterized as whiners, a few outliers who had unique circumstances that were contributing to the problems. And we were unable to get any traction with any kind of proposals. Now, I have not been involved prior to this session directly in the proposal, so I can't tell you specifically what was proposed, but I know that there were comprehensive reform proposals that were put forth in those prior sessions.
May I follow up?
Follow up.
So I guess what I'm hearing is that your clients or some subset of your clients, and maybe including some others, brought proposals to the legislature, and the legislature, without passing judgment on it, did not see merit enough in those proposals to take action. So wouldn't it then be fair to assume that the legislature was essentially saying that the policy that it had on the books was the policy it wanted to have on the books?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I've been around the legislative process too long to draw any inference from legislative inaction. There are many, many reasons why the legislature may fail to act, not the least of which is the very effective advocacy of my colleague, Mr. Hartman, and his clients. Also, it would be inaccurate to say that the legislature took no action. 2 years ago, there were amendments to the reserving statutes that were intended to address the problem. The problem was that they had not properly diagnosed what the problem was that they were trying to solve, and so it didn't really get at the problem. But it isn't that the legislature was turning a blind eye completely to the problem. It certainly didn't have the attention that it's received in this session, but I think your predecessor representatives and senators were not simply saying we like the way it is and we want to continue it that way, and I think that would be a very unfair inference.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
May I follow?
Follow up.
Thanks. And leaving that aside, the absence of some action by the legislature, and there was nothing to prevent, for example, the 1999 legislature, the 1979 legislature, the 2001 legislature, from saying, we want to make sure people understand that we think of the assumed interest rate as not just a floor, but a ceiling as well. There would have been nothing to have prevented the legislature from making that clear and doing what we essentially did earlier this session by specifically directing that earnings above 8% be put into a reduction in the deficit account or a reserve for future years.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, certainly there was nothing that I'm aware of that prevented the legislature from doing that other than the focus on other matters.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mike, did you want to testify today? No, I'm going to wait. Anybody else wanted to testify today? Everybody's waiting for amendments. Okay. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2003. It'll be up again on Thursday. And if there's nothing else for the good of the committee, committee's adjourned.